All right, Luke chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 27. Luke 5, verse 27. Late last year, I received this gift. This is called an Amazon Echo. What is an Echo? Well, let me introduce you to the Echo, or let me introduce you to her. Alexa, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
She's cordial, which is very nice. And she knows her Bible. Alexa, why don't you quote for us a Bible verse?
This might answer your question. Here is a Bible verse from the King James Bible. Genesis 7:20 reads, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Alexa. In addition to answering Bible questions or quoting the Bible, she can answer puzzles as well. Alexa, how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
A woodchuck would chuck all the wood he could chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Okay. So this is a marvelous piece of technology, and really you can ask her anything. We have Lori kind of helping our girls with math, and they'll shout out like math problems, complicated math problems, and she's able to answer them. You can order pizza and Jimmy John's and car parts. She is fantastic. But what's interesting, though, is that most people use Alexa for basics, for simple answers to simple questions, or answers to what seem to be simple questions. So a survey was held in the UK in 2018. I think it was about 1,000 people that were brought into the survey asking, what are the questions that you ask Alexa? 12% asked specifically, how do we distract our kids, which I thought was interesting. 10% asked for tips on dating, which I think is fair enough. But then 20% of Brits surveyed asked the question, how do I boil an egg? How do I boil an egg? So I'm not sure what's going on in the UK, but there it is. And when you look at the list of questions that are asked, they're simple questions that result in simple answers. And I think there's a lesson in that for us, because if you think about it, most of the big problems in life, they really boil down to the neglect of basic principles in life. So the big problems in life are usually due to us neglecting basic principles in life. And so something happens and immediately we're drawn to the most complicated solution, when all we need to do is kind of go back to the basics, go to the rudiments, go to the foundation, and usually therein lies the solution. So if you are a parent, man, I'm telling you, parenting is very, very tough, because of which you're going to want to read all the books on parenting. You're going to want to master the theories, and I want to encourage you, do that, read the books, master the theories. But the reality is, you can read all the books, and yet if you miss a principle like this, when your kids throw a tantrum, you don't throw a tantrum, then all that book learning will do nothing. Right, this week, no joke, my kid throws a tantrum, and I said, I see your tantrum, and I raise it. And that's what I did. You can raise your voice? Oh, yeah? Do you know what I do for a living? I preach. Watch this. And I brought out the music stand, and I didn't do that. But I did raise my voice, and it was so amazing. Here is this pastor who has taught on parenting and knows all of the complex theories as much as I've had time to study, and yet I'm missing something. So basic. And the same is true with marriage. Marriage is tough, because of which, read all the books, right? Read about love languages and filling love tanks and his and her needs. Please do that. Nevertheless, you can't forget the basics. How often we miss the basics. I've counseled many couples who, they could cite the books, and they know the theories, and they want to go to their love tanks to be the solution to their particular marital woes, and I've had to stop them, and I've had to say, how about this? Before we address that book, how about you stop being a self-absorbed jerk? How about that? And And then we could talk about theories. Otherwise, you know what happens? If you don't deal with your personal narcissism, you will weaponize all of that material. Instead of making this complicated, how about this? How about treating your spouse like Jesus tells you to treat your enemies? If you did just that, your marriage would flourish. Think about what Jesus says. He says, this is how you treat your enemies. You pray for them. You do good to them. You go the extra mile for them. When they insult you, you don't insult them in turn. As much as it depends upon you, be at peace with your enemy. How many of you know that if you apply that to your spouse, so much of our problems in our marriage will disappear? So yes, theories are important. You know, learning the complexities of it, marriage is complex, but you can't miss the basics of marriage, of child rearing, and certainly you can't miss the basics related to who God is and how we relate to God. You see, this passage that we're reading this morning, Jesus is answering a couple of very basic questions about God. They're rudimentary, and yet people are getting them wrong. People are overcomplicating these questions. They're getting them terribly wrong, and all by a group of people who are professionals. I mean, these are self-styled. In fact, they've graduated from school as those experts in a relationship with God, and yet they're missing the very basics. And so God, through Christ, is going to instruct them, and not just them, also us, on some of the basics of a relationship with God. And that's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to look at two simple questions, and they are these. Number one, how do I start a relationship with God? How do I start a relationship with God? And then number two, once having started that relationship with God, how do I grow in that relationship with God? How do I start one? How do I grow in that relationship? And to answer those questions, Jesus will present two dominant, driving, powerful, gripping images to help anchor the answers. One image is of God being a doctor, and the second image is of God being a groom. As applied to Jesus, Jesus the doctor, Jesus the groom, he'll use these images to bring answers to these simple questions, and then he'll wrap up this lesson to these Pharisees and these scribes by giving a cluster of images related to newness, and we'll get to that in a moment. So let's look at the first question. Number one, how do I start a relationship with God? How do I start a relationship with God? Let's pick up in verse 27, Luke chapter 5. We read that after this, Jesus went out. So after this, Jesus went out. If you're new here, we've been working through the Gospel of Luke. We just started, kind of. It's going to take us a while, but we're at this point in the book where Jesus is just beginning his earthly public ministry. He's been quiet for 30 years, and now it's the time. The trigger has been tripped, and now he is out there. He is preaching, he is ministering, and this is at the very beginning. He's gathering his disciples to him, and so we see this particular disciple gathered to him. He went out, verse 27, and saw a tax collector named Levi. We know Levi as Matthew, as the guy who wrote the first book in the New Testament. His name will change, and we'll talk about why his name changes in a moment. So he saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at a tax booth, or at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." Follow me. Those aren't just words. There's something supernatural taking place here. There's something powerful and effectual taking place. These two words and maybe we'll never get to the bottom of it on this side of heaven. These two words are able to take a guy locked in his lifestyle, locked in his criminal trade, locked in a trajectory that keeps going further and further away from God. And these two particular words are able to stop him in his criminal activity, and they draw him right to Jesus. Jesus says, "Follow me," and leaving everything. This guy's rich. This guy's filthy rich. Leaving everything, he rose and followed him. So the question is this: how do I start a relationship with God? How do you start a relationship with God? And the first part of an answer to this question is this. Notice here that a relationship with God always starts with what God does first. A relationship with God always starts with what God does first. He initiates, we respond. He acts, we react. Before Levi sees Jesus and does anything for Jesus, Jesus sees Levi and does something for him. Jesus is the one who starts the relationship with him. Before you called out to Jesus this morning, if you are a Christian, Jesus first, he must have first called out to you. The relationship that you have with God, if you have one, always starts with him. It starts with a calling. And this calling is a special, individualized, customized, supernatural calling. It's so powerful that it's able to take Levi's like us and turn us into Matthews. At some point, and I think it's precisely because of what happens in this episode, Levi changes his name to Matthew, and appropriately so, because that word Matthew, that name Matthew, literally means a gift of Yahweh. By grace, the Bible says, you've been saved through faith. It's not that of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works that no one should boast. Salvation is of grace from beginning to end. And so here Jesus calls out to Levi, and Levi's caught in the tractor beam of grace and mercy, and he is brought close. He is brought to Jesus. This is what some theologians call the effectual call of God upon his people. That, yeah, the gospel goes forth universally, and yet there's the summons that happens deeply in our hearts, that goes deeper than what we hear. It's the effectual call of God. It's what Paul means, I think, in Romans 8:30 when he says, "For whom he predestined, these he also called." Or as he says in 1 Corinthians 1:22, we preach Christ crucified, who is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. But to the called, Jesus becomes the wisdom of God and the power of God. To the called. It's a call that's different than the universal call. It goes deep. It gets into our heart. It turns our heart towards God. It gives us a brand new heart. It says, the Westminster Catechism puts it, effectual calling is the work of God's Spirit, whereby convincing us of our sin and misery, enlightening our minds with the knowledge of Christ, renewing our wills, the Spirit does persuade us to accept and to embrace Christ freely offered to us in the gospel. That has to be happening here. I mean, there's no other explanation for why this guy gets up and leaves and follows Jesus. Salvation is a gift through and through. And so Jesus is walking along, and he sees this tax collector plying his trade. Now the question is, what precisely did Jesus see when he saw Levi? And there's a sense in which Jesus sees something different than the religious leaders are seeing. So Jesus is looking at Levi, and the Pharisees and the scribes, the religious leaders of the day, are looking at Levi. And in one sense, they're seeing the same thing, right? They're seeing the tax booth. They're seeing Levi with this bling all purchased from money extorted from his people. Both Jesus and the religious leaders, they're seeing the arrogance. They're seeing the criminal record. They're seeing the criminal activity happening right underneath their nose. Both Jesus and the religious leaders see a rascal, see a man who is evil and despicable. He's a man who literally has bid on the right to have a franchise there in this part of Israel, whereby he extorts taxes for Rome from his own people, inflating the prices in order to line his own pockets and to make a killing. Levi is evil. Levi is despicable. Levi is far from God. And you know, Jesus sees that too. Arguably, Jesus sees more darkness, more brokenness. Sees a man so much further from God than the Pharisees and the scribes could ever see. But notice in the next couple of verses, though they both see Levi as a criminal, they don't just see him. Jesus doesn't just see him as a criminal. Notice what else Jesus sees, verse 29. And Levi made him a great feast in his house, and there was a large company of tax collectors. And these are despicable people and others reclining at the table. And the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled at the disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And notice how Jesus changes the imagery away from criminality to something else. Jesus answered them, saying, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." The Pharisees only see a criminal. Jesus sees a criminal as well as someone who is desperately, spiritually ill, that unless they're wheeled into an OR, as it were, and cut open, heart operated on, heart made new, this person is on the brink of perishing. Jesus sees a sick man, morally, spiritually, emotionally, relationally sick. And so Jesus is drawn like a doctor to a virus, like a doctor to a broken bone. Jesus, his compassion is pulled. He's drawn towards this man who on the surface you would be repelled by. But he's drawn to the man because of his sickness. And Levi now, because his eyes have been opened, because of the call, because of the summons, because of the work of God's Spirit, Levi sees this about himself. He knew he was a criminal, but now he knows he is desperately sick. And what is the reflex? What is the immediate response? He grabs onto Jesus. He embraces Jesus by faith. Levi gets it. Look at it like this. What would you do if someone charged you with a knife and they were trying to cut your abdomen open? What would you do if someone did that to you? And of course you know what you would do. You would either run or you would fight. And you would seek to remove the knife from them. You would disable them. You might even use the knife on them, right? That's the natural response to someone charging you with a knife. But let's turn this around. Let's say you come to and you realize you've been unconscious because you were in a horrendous car accident, and you are informed that you have severe internal bleeding, and unless that guy with a knife cut open your abdomen, you will certainly perish. How many of you know your relationship to that man now changes? How you will plead with him, "Cut me open." How you will embrace that person to go in deep, to do what is necessary in order to make you well. Matthew gets it. Jesus calls, Matthew gets it. And this is precisely where we begin to answer that question, how do I start a relationship with God? This is basic, but here it is. It's when the Spirit of God touches your heart and convinces you that you are desperately ill spiritually, that you can't fix yourself, you're on the brink of perishing, but God has sent Dr. Jesus into the world in order to cut you open with the grace of forgiveness and repentance and life, in order to apply the cure of the gospel, because of which, when it dawns on you, you can't help but to embrace him as doctor. That's how relationship with God works. And this is what Matthew sees. This is what he gets. This is Christianity 101. And I would ask you this morning, maybe you've heard about Christianity, maybe you've been a Christian for a long time, does your relationship center on this? Is this the foundation of it? And if it's not the foundation of your relationship with God through Christ, Jesus is irrelevant to you. And if not irrelevant, Jesus may even be offensive to you. Because think about it. Notice how the Pharisees and the scribes are offended by Jesus. Because what Jesus is doing here, he is saying, I am a Messiah to both groups of people. They're offended that Jesus is hanging out with these morally grimy people, and yet the same Messiah also comes for them, the Pharisees and the scribes. And what they're saying is, well, wait a minute, Jesus. They're the bad guys and we're the good guys. They are the unclean people. We are the clean people. They are the impure. We are the pure. Didn't you come to save the good guys? Isn't that the mission of the Messiah? It's like this. When I was a kid, and if you moms do this, I just want to give you a subtle rebuke not to do this ever again. When I was a kid, like my brothers and I, we would have like caked on pudding on our face, you know, just kind of all over. And my mom would spit into her shirt, and she would take that shirt drenched in her nasty spittle, and she would proceed to wash my brother's face. And then, using the same spittle cloth, wash my face. That's wrong, just to let you know. Stop it! I mean, first of all, do you really think your spittle, as you're eating lunch, as you're drinking coffee, is really cleaner than the pudding caked on the face? That's number one. Number two, in my case, my mom starts with my brother, who is far dirtier than I could ever be, right? I'm the clean one. He's the dirty one. I'm the pure one. He's the impure one. And here she is working on his face, and she thinks that somehow applying that same cloth is going to clean me up. It's going to make me worse. It's going to make me terribly worse. The Pharisees and the scribes are thinking the same thing. How can you be a Messiah for the bad guys too? How can you be hanging out with these morally grimy people? And so Jesus started to offend them. They didn't understand his role as doctor in their own lives. God only comes to save good people. And the fact is, we do what they're doing. I mean, every one of us, we divide the world between the good people and the bad people. Right, the pure and the impure. The thing is that we divide the line differently in such a way that our sins are the acceptable ones, aren't they? Yeah, we don't do that. Those are the bad sins. These are the good sins. You know, those are the bad lifestyles. These are the good lifestyles, or at least the more acceptable sinful lifestyles. And we conveniently divide the world between bad and good, because of which, if you do that, Jesus as a doctor will never make sense. This is why he doesn't make sense to the Pharisees and the scribes, because Jesus is essentially saying here in our text, as he gives the illustration of doctor, this wasn't so much designed to lay out his role with the tax collectors. They already get it. It's the fact that these people don't recognize that this must be the role he must have with them, the good guys, that they're not really good, that they too are sick, that they too are fallen. And Jesus says, if you don't consider yourself sick, I can be no doctor to you. I can bring no healing to you. My salvation will be irrelevant to you. This is the story you may have heard of the man who was trying to, Well, he wanted to paint the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15 at the point where he hits rock bottom, squandering his father's estate, and is now totally abject in poverty and homeless. And so this painter found a beggar, an unkept beggar in his community, and said, I will hire you to be the model for the prodigal son. The next day, the beggar showed up. However, he shaved his beard, and he combed his hair, and he took a bath, and he wore cleaner clothes. He didn't look like a beggar anymore. And when the artist saw that, he says, oh no, I can use you no longer. Herein lies Christianity 101. Listen very carefully. Good people don't go to heaven. Good people don't go to heaven. Only the bad ones do. Jesus did not come to save good people who have their act together, who have some self-righteousness that they can barter with God for, because of which God will say, you were a good guy. You know, I grade on a curve. You're better than most. Come on in. Jesus doesn't save those people. He saves people who know they flunked the test over and over again. And if you don't get that, you haven't started a relationship with God. This is where it starts. Has this been the place a relationship with God has started with you? The image of Jesus as doctor, you as terminal patient who needs his healing hand. That's the answer to the first question. Here's the second question. So number two, having started a relationship with God, how do you grow in it? How do you grow in a relationship with God? And I want you to notice in our text, and you'll see this in a moment, all of a sudden the image changes. Certainly Jesus as doctor still is relevant to us as Christians growing in our relationship with God. But now the image changes from Jesus being doctor in an emergency operating room to Jesus being a groom on a wedding day. And this image, too, is in response to criticisms leveled by the Pharisees and the scribes against now Jesus' disciples. It's interesting. In the first criticism, they're pointing out what the tax collectors have done, their record. Look at the bad things they've done. And now, in this next series of criticisms, they're pointing out what the known followers of Jesus aren't doing. Look at what they're not doing. Look at how they're not praying, how they're not fasting. And so we read, look at verse 33, and they said to him, the disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees. But look at yours. They eat, and they drink, and they laugh, and they revel. They're part of the great feast. In other words, I mean, this is not a question, this is an accusation. How come they're not praying more? How come they're not serving more, fasting more? Jesus, what about the rules? What about the rituals? What about the law? What about holiness? What about seriousness? What about evangelism and mission? What happened to the rules, Jesus? What happened to the law? Your disciples aren't following the rules like every other serious believer of something. And so here is the criticism. Now notice how Jesus responds, and he responds with this image. Verse 34, Jesus said to them, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? And the word wedding guest there is literally the attendants of the groom, or we might say groomsmen. Can you make the groomsmen fast while the bridegroom is with them? Verse 35, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. Notice what Jesus is not doing. He's not discarding ritual or the rules or obedience or the law or prayers or fasting. What he is addressing, however, is what seems to be, on the part of these people, an unhealthy relationship with the rules. They're getting the rules wrong. They're getting their relationship with the commandments wrong. They're getting their relationship with ritual and fasting and prayers and the Christian life totally wrong. Now, we know you can get your relationship to God's rules wrong in two different ways. Number one, through your disobedience. That makes sense enough. But do you know that you can get your relationship with God's rules totally wrong through your obedience? You can obey God and get God's law wrong. You can obey His word and yet be fundamentally disobedient. And this is how it happens when you miss the image of Him as groom. When you allow the rules to be deeper than the relationship, instead of allowing the relationship to be deeper than the rules. That is your notion of the Christian life. It's rules at bottom, and somehow it works into God being pleased with you. Jesus thinking you're awesome. Jesus allowing you to have that parking spot in Walmart. Why? Because I've been obeying the rules. I've been a good boy. I've been a good girl. I've done the right thing. Right, I've bartered with God, and I've done the right thing. He kind of owes me, and so I can expect certain things in my life. Rules first, and then out of that comes a kind of relationship, which is an absolute inversion of what it's all about. It's missing the basics, the fundamentals of how you grow in a relationship with God. I mean, the immediate image here is of groomsmen who naturally fast. And I've done enough weddings to see this over and over again. You get a bunch of groomsmen, and they might be the most manly men on the planet. But I'm telling you, once you tell them that they're going to stand on a platform before crowds of people, all of a sudden, they can't eat. They can't drink. They're pale. When they get on the platform, I have to tell them, don't lock their knees because they start to swoon. I have to instruct them to breathe deeply because their breaths are shallow. All they want, more than anyone else in that room, even more than the bride and the groom, all they want is for the bride and the groom to tie the knot so that they can get off of the platform and so they can party. And so the knot is tied, and they, with empty stomach, go to an open bar, and the party goes down. You've seen this story over and over again. Now, here's the point. You don't have to tell the groomsmen to be nervous or to fast or to not drink, right? You don't have to tell them that. It just comes out of the rule. It flows naturally from the environment. It comes out of the scene. Now, in our text, I think we're invited to look at this even deeper because every other instance where God is described as a groom, His disciples aren't described as groomsmen. His disciples are described as the bride. As the bride. So if you're a Christian, and guys, this may be tough to swallow, you're Jesus' bride. You are the bride of Christ, and we are waiting for Him in anticipation. And it's because of the love, because we're madly in love with Him, because we're head over heels with Him, the prayers naturally rise. The obedience happens. The endeavors for Him take place. The sacrifices, the fastings, the Christian life naturally flows from the relationship. You see, relationship first, rules second. Relationship first, rules second. Isn't that happening back in verse 29? I mean, look at this verse. It's amazing. Jesus tells this man who is caught in his lifestyle, come follow me. God does that supernatural work of making this man new. And notice what happens naturally as a result of great grace poured into his heart. And the natural result is a great feast put on by Matthew for Jesus. Jesus didn't say, throw me a feast. I command it of you. The first assignment that I have of you is that you throw me a party. There's no commandment here. There are no rules or regulations here. It's out of the flow of grace that God takes a man, and we know him. He's a stingy man. He's a tight-fisted man. He's a man who's been hoarding all of his life. He's been taking and not giving. And yet, great grace gets into his heart and it transforms a stingy man into a giver, a taker into a giver, tight fists into open hands. How did that happen? Did Jesus legislate it? Did Matthew look at the rules? The reality is he knew the rules. He knew the law. He knew the prohibitions against coveting. The law did nothing to change his heart. The thunderings of Sinai did nothing to change his heart. It was grace. It was love. It was the relationship. As Gordon Fee puts it, in Christianity, religion is grace, ethics is gratitude. In Christianity, religion is grace. Salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. To God alone be the glory. And the Christian life is pure, pure gratitude. When a man and a woman fall deeply in love with each other, let's say they have no idea because they're naive and maybe grew up sheltered, they have no idea how to express themselves physically and affection towards one another. How many of you know all you need is for them to be madly in love with each other, and you don't need to command, nor do you need to give rules on how they are to be affectionate to one another? They will learn how. You don't have to tell them how to kiss and how to hug and snuggle and hold hands. Man, all you need is the love, and that flows from it. In Christianity, religion is all grace, and the Christian life is all gratitude. How do you grow as a Christian? Well, you might be tempted to get the list, the do's, the don'ts. I call them the do-do list, you know. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, do that. Or, better yet, you can do this. Fall more and more in love with your Savior. Be smitten by His beauty, His greatness, His graciousness more and more. Realize the cost of His grace. Realize what He has given to you, and the Christian life must just naturally happen. Look at it like this. There's a scene in the book of Jeremiah where the Israelites, because they're missing the image of the groom, they're handling God's commandments, His rules, the Christian life, the Jewish life, wrong, both through their disobedience and their twisted obedience. So disobedience and obedience. And so God in Jeremiah 2, in order to give the corrective, guess what image He gives to help reset them spiritually? It's the image of a groom. And it's a fascinating image of a groom because there's a mixture of metaphor that takes place. And this is what God says to Israel. He says, "Has a maiden forgot her ornaments and a bride her attire? And yet you have forgotten me." Now think about this. It's in the context where He's saying, "I am your groom." And yet notice what He's saying, what He is here. He's saying, "I'm not just your groom. I am your wedding dress." Has a bride forgotten her dress? You've forgotten me. I mean, what bride ever forgets her dress on her wedding day? Oh, I forgot my dress. What bride forgets to make up her hair, to do her face? I mean, what bride doesn't look the most splendid in her life on that particular day? She is totally made up for the occasion. And yet God says, "You have forgotten me." In other words, God says, "I am your wedding dress. I am the makeup that makes you beautiful, acceptable, presentable. I am your ornamentation. I am your glory. It's my glory put on you that brings you near to me in this relational matrimony between God and His people. By the way, it is my clothing that I put on you at great cost to myself." Because in the gospel, Jesus is stripped of His garments, viciously brutalized so that you might have His garments. Jesus is disfigured. He is made ugly, marred more than any man, Isaiah 52 and 53 declare, so that He can in turn give you His beauty. He takes His ornaments of righteousness and he places it on you to bring you near. And I'm telling you, what one of us, when we have that image of him as groom in the forefront of our minds, how could we not pray and love and serve and follow? Not out of the drudgery of duty and discipline, but because our hearts explode with worship and gratitude. It's about the relationship. The rules flow as a response to the relationship. That's how you grow. True religion is grace. Ethics is gratitude. And it's at this point, Jesus gives us a concluding image. They're a cluster of similar images. They have the same point. I'm going to give you these images, and then we're going to head to the table. Jesus wraps up this teaching to anchor these images in our heart, to challenge us this morning, better yet, to entice us to think that maybe we're settling for something that we shouldn't settle with, that we're not seeing the brand new life that God has for us. This is what Jesus says, verse 36. He told them a parable saying, "No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old." Verse 37, "And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. No one, after drinking old wine, wants the good stuff, desires the new. For he says, because he's used to it, the old is good enough." The illustrations are straightforward. First illustration, you're cutting blackberry bushes, and you tear your cotton t-shirt, like, horribly. And when you do that, certainly what you don't do is you don't go down to Kohl's or Walmart and purchase, say, a new cotton t-shirt and then cut a hole out of it and try to patch the old cotton t-shirt, right? Because you ruin the new one, and then it's not really going to work with the old one, because you'll wash it, you'll dry it, and it'll tear, the new piece will tear from the old, and you will have spoiled both. So we know that image. Second image isn't as familiar, because not many of us walk around with flasks of Cabernet Sauvignon, right? You're not walking around, "Hey, by the way, look at my flagon of Pinot Noir," right? No one, people carry guns in Mason County. You probably don't carry wine with you, but back then, I mean, they would carry flagons of wine, thermoses of wine, and the thermoses were made out of animal skins, and these animal skins, if you have them long enough, they would reach the capacity of their expansion. And what you would not do when they've done that, you would never put new fermenting wine into those old wineskins, because it's chemically active, it's dynamic, and the gases would cause the skin to break, and you would ruin both skin and the new wine. So that's the second image. Both images are saying, you can't have new and old. It's either one or the other. You abandon the old, you embrace the new. Now, these two parables close with a sobering parable, an illustration. It's found in verse 39. This is where I'm going to close. This is where I'm going to land. Verse 39, "No one, after drinking the old wine," you're used to the old wine, that's all you drink, "ever desires the new. For he says, the old is good enough." You see, he's referring to people who can't imagine anything better than the old. People who can't imagine anything better than their old life, their old patterns of behavior, their old addictions, their old legalisms. They can't imagine anything better, and so they settle for the old. They settle for their old sickness. They can't imagine Jesus as doctor, and they certainly are honest with themselves, so they settle with their own sickness. There's a kind of safety in the old, a safety in what's broken and what's dysfunctional. And that sounds strange, doesn't it? That someone would settle for their sickness so much that the greatest physician could come along, offer new life, and they miss the new life because they're holding on to the old. All they know is the old. And yet that happens all the time. There's a scene in John chapter 5 where Jesus, he approaches a man who's been paralyzed for 38 years, and Jesus asks the strangest question. He says, "Do you want to be healed?" I mean, at one level, that's ridiculous. Of course he does. I don't have to ask my wife, "Do you want a dozen flowers?" Or my kids, "You want $100, no strings attached." Like, they're like, yes, I don't have to ask that question. And certainly, you don't have to ask someone who's been suffering all of their lives, "Do you want to be made healed?" You don't walk down hospital hallways saying, "You don't really want to be healed, do you? Do you really want to be healed?" That would be offensive. And yet, Jesus' question suggests the real possibility that people feel safe, they are settled with their old sickness, and deep down, they don't want what it takes to be healed. And that's a reality, not just then, that's a reality here. People today, they settle for their old sickness because they can't imagine a joy greater than those old patterns of living. They can't even grasp Matthew's party here. Like, what are you so happy about? If I did that, I would be miserable. They can't imagine that there's a joy beyond the highs of their sinful dysfunction. And so they settle for the sickness. And they miss the new life. Again, people today, they settle for the old sickness over new life because they fear the responsibility of being healthy more than they hate the disability of their sickness. In other words, if they're really made new, if things were changed, then in the case of the paralytic, he would be expected to walk and then run and to work. And that just seems impossible. That seems overwhelming. It's safer to be where I was at. And some people, when they think of Christianity, they hear the idea of the Christian life, and that seems so foreign to them, so alien, so impossible to them that they think there's no way. There's no way. When they don't realize that the love of God that comes into our hearts and makes us new is the same love of God that fuels and forms brand new, powerful, life-changing affections in our hearts, out of which the Christian life naturally flows. But people don't see that, and they miss the new for the old. Again, people today, they settle for their old sickness over new life because they have learned to derive their identity from their sickness. In fact, some, they call their sickness, they've learned to redefine it as what's healthy, as what should be approved of. And the fact is, we've always thought that that's what only religious people do, but we live in a culture that is increasingly secular, and that is the tactic of our culture, to tell you, how do you deal with what's wrong with your heart, with those desires in your heart? And our culture says, this is what you do. Don't say those are sick desires. Say they're healthy desires. Our culture says the real sickness is to call it a sickness. That's what needs to be condemned. What needs to be done is that your sickness is labeled health to be celebrated and approved. Whatever desires come out of your heart. All the while missing the great physician, missing the new life. Do you want to be healed? Do you want the great physician to minister life to you? That sounds strange, but now do you see why it's not? Do you see why that even now, this morning, some of you have to do some serious business with God? You're feeling the tug. You're feeling the tug this morning. You're feeling the summons of Dr. Jesus, and you're trying to replay all of those arguments to argue why this really isn't relevant to you. Don't resist the summons of Jesus. Respond to the call of Dr. Jesus. Respond to the lover of your soul and experience new life.